thanks to Masoma for sponsoring the first series of The Making Of. Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Masoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative, and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Masoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Masoma.com. You're listening to The Making Of, a brand new podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. We talk about the highs and the lows and the turning points that have shaped their lives, but don't worry, I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest this week is the journalist and broadcaster, Christiane Amanpour.
And I do believe, as Madeleine Albright said famously, there is a special place in hell reserved for women who do not want to help other women.
Christiane is the chief international anchor of CNN and host of their flagship global affairs show called, quite rightly, Amanpour, full stop. She joined CNN in the 80s and has reported from every conflict and war zone and interviewed historic world leaders. We talked about the defining moments in Christiane's life and covered being liked, women helping other women, and raising boys. But the start of this interview is a bit different. We recorded it over Zoom during lockdown at the start of June 2020. It was just after George Floyd was killed. So we were talking right in the middle of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations that were happening all around the world. And that is where our conversation begins. What a week. You had quite the scoop, didn't you, with that? Well, not a scoop, but a real moment with the chief of Houston police saying what he did.
Yes, I did. I did because he came onto my program as we were getting information about what President Trump had done in, I believe, a video conference with governors from all over the country. And somebody there had recorded it and had put it out for the press. I'm not sure they were meant to, but they did. And in it, it was clear that the President of the United States, when faced by a massive crisis in his country, seemed very rattled, seemed to just go off like he generally does. And now we can see this is a character attribute of his. He goes off, he blames, he looks for enemies. He's always talking about domination and weak and strong. And this is what he said in this conference to these governors. And so I asked the police chief who I had in front of me, who would have been tasked with, quote unquote, a strong response if the president, you know, had ordered it. But he's not constitutionally able to order that from a police chief. So I said to the police, because I've covered many uprisings, and I'm not going to call these riots, actually. I'm being very careful about what I say here. I have covered uprisings and political struggles all over the world. And I asked this police chief, who himself is an immigrant from Cuba, came over when he was a kid to the United States, policing what they call in America a majority-minority city. In other words, minorities make up most of the population. And he has tried to win hearts and minds. And so that's what he said to me. You know, it's not about domination, dominance. It's about trying to win hearts and minds. And then he said, yes, if the President of the United States doesn't have anything constructive to say, please keep your mouth shut. This is not The Apprentice. We need leadership. Yeah. And I thought it was very, very brave. And I very much hope he doesn't suffer any professional consequences or personal consequences. You are interviewing me at a very crucial global moment.
Yeah. And actually, while we're talking about it, do you feel like that part of this is the convergence of COVID and this happening? Do you think that maybe there's an extra level of being at the edge because of this as well?
Well, I think there is an extra level of being at the edge, but we would be naive and not honest if we said that this was sort of launched because of the tensions of COVID. Because police killing unarmed Black men and women in America has been going on for decades, you know, before COVID. And you know that it's a legacy of 400 years of slavery in America. And there has never been a truth and reconciliation, you know, like there was in South Africa. There has never been a communal moment where, you know, the nation comes to grips with its original sin and opens its arms to all its people. You know, the black people make up, black Americans make up 10% or so of the population. And yet disproportionately, they suffer in every which way, whether it's socioeconomically, obviously in terms of police violence, obviously in terms of incarceration in prisons, in terms of health. And COVID also highlighted, not just in the United States, but here too, and around the world, how blacks and other minorities are disproportionately paying the price in terms of infection and death. And that's about race, and it's about socioeconomics, it's about resources that have not been poured into those communities, and it's endemic, and it's not just now, it's forever. Coupled with the fact that these are the people who have gone to the front lines because they have no choice, and because they believe in doing their job. They are the key workers who are either hospital cleaners, porters, whoever they might be, grocery store workers, bus drivers, you know, tube and public transport providers. Whoever they are, they're doing our quote unquote dirty work on the front lines. And every week we go out, in the US it was every night, we go out and applaud them. So you can't applaud them and deny them their rights and treat them like subhuman beings. What happened to George Floyd in the United States was an unacceptable act of violence by the police to somebody who was pleading for his life. And again, it's not the first one, of course.
And you're very clear about this because you believe in truth, not neutrality. And
yes,
this
I
is
do.
Really coming out now.
It is. And you know, if you want to go back to the 6 moments, and I'll let you do it in a second. My moments of my life led to here and to all the other major global issues that I've covered, because it has led me to understand the responsibility of being a journalist with a massive platform like CNN, and the code of conduct and the code of ethics that goes into being a journalist. In other words, you have to be educated enough and experienced enough to recognize what you're seeing. You can't be some wide-eyed, doe-eyed, naive man or woman who goes out there and says, oh, this is happening on this side, this is happening on that side, let's make them all equal, because often they are not. So we cannot create a false factual or false moral equivalence when none exists. So it's truthful, not neutral. And that's what we have to be aware of in this situation as well.
There's a quote from you which says, so Christiane once said, what you do, what you say, how you react to critical situations defines not just the moment, but it defines and shapes you perhaps forever, which is very fitting as today we're talking about your 6 moments that shaped your life. Do you believe in defining moments?
I think I do. I mean, I don't think I'm a prisoner of defining moments, and I don't put too much emphasis in them. But I do believe that, you know, most human lives have defining moments for good or for bad, and they do shape you. You can't help but be shaped by your experience, your environment, and how people react to you and how you react in return. So I do believe that, yeah.
So let's go to your 6 moments, which you've chosen, the moments that shaped you and brought you to where you are now. The first one we have is moving to Iran. You were born in the UK. So your mother is British and your father is Iranian. What age did you move to Iran?
Well, they were living in Iran. To be honest, my mother just came over to Britain, where her parents were, to have me, because the obstetrics, the hospitals, you know, the medical process and system was probably a lot more advanced. We're talking 60 odd years ago. And in fact, she had all of us sisters in England. It was great, because it gave us, you know, dual nationality at the time. And it was a wonderful thing to have that expanded horizon. But to be fair, I was immediately, after a couple of weeks, taken back to Iran, which is where we all grew up, and we spent the entire, you know, couple of decades before the revolution of 1979. So my earliest memories and earliest experiences are in Iran.
And did you feel like you had did you feel slightly different having that multicultural family in Tehran, Or do you
No, because there were quite a lot of so-called foreigners in Iran at the time. It was when Iran was opening up. Iran was becoming a power in the oil industry. And they imported a lot of workers from abroad. And my mom is a Roman Catholic. We were raised Roman Catholics. And so in the church, which we went to every Sunday, we met a lot of Catholics from the Philippines, from America, from other parts of Europe, other parts of the world. And so I grew up knowing that, you know, all, strangely it served me, you know, maybe I didn't figure it out at the time, but just being in a society and in a situation where there were all cultures jammed together and all religions jammed together. I grew up in a Catholic and Muslim household, and I never, ever was ever aware, or nobody ever modeled to me any behavior that suggested that there was a difference between any nationalities or ethnicities or religions. And that has really served me. That is a very defining moment. And also, given that I grew up in a patriarchal society, and given that my father was Iranian, who had four daughters and no sons, in a society that values sons much more than daughters, I will always be grateful to my father for valuing us so much, us girls, and for never, ever even thinking or implying that there was anything second class about being a girl. And that was very empowering, very, very empowering.
And you wanted to be a doctor at that point?
Well, then I had been sent at the age of 11 from Iran to boarding school because I guess they thought the education in the UK was better at the time than the education, secondary education in Iran. And yeah, I was very good at sciences, chemistry, biology, and physics. And I thought that I wanted to be a doctor because that's also a cliche. In many, many countries, certainly out there, girls can aspire to be nurses or doctors or teachers. You know, that's cool. Not engineers, not architects, not astrophysicists, but at the time, nurses, doctors, you know, teachers. And so I guess maybe that was, you know, ingrained, and that's what I thought. But also I was good at the sciences. So I did very well in my O-levels at that time, it was pre-GCSE. And then I had to move school. And when I went to another convent for my A-levels, unfortunately at that time, parents didn't ask schools what they were good at, or were they good at the subjects that their girls wanted to study. So the result was that they were lousy at the sciences, and I did not do well at all in the sciences. So I didn't get the grades to go to medical school.
And this is this is kind of the second moment, is really failing to get the grades you wanted to become a doctor. Yes. And yes, that's quite an interesting plot point, I guess, in your life, because if you had got them, would you have become a doctor? We wouldn't have had Amanpour, you know, the world would have been a different place perhaps.
Well, I'm not going to go that far, but probably I might not have been a journalist. And, you know, I always say too that if it hadn't been for the Iranian Revolution, I probably would not have been a journalist. So out of that sort of upheaval and, you know, disruption politically, culturally in my own home, so that colliding with the fact that I was not able to be a doctor, it made me refocus my future and my ambition. And it was in the middle of watching the revolution unfold that I decided that I wanted to be a journalist.
So just going back to the education that you had in the boarding schools in the UK, I've heard you saying that they were very strict, there was corporal punishment. I mean, that experience, was that something that built resilience in you, or did it build frustration and anger?
It built rebellion and anger, but also resilience. And, you know, it made you realize, look, you can deal, you know, in life you can deal if you choose to. And look, when I say corporal punishment, yes, rulers on the hands, you know, brushes on the thighs, you know, it wasn't great, but it wasn't all the time. But we did get, it was strict. And, you know, mostly when I misbehaved or broke a rule or whatever it was, mostly not knowing what the rules were, you know, we had to actually clean the school. So and this was in my first convent. So I always say that actually I learned a lot about cleaning, and I'm a very good cleaner. And
it must have been it must have been toughening being away from home as well. And I'm just kind of wondering if is what has helped you be, you know, a gutsy, brave person that we know you to be.
Well, you know, it's not easy being a kid being sent away from home. You don't really understand it. You're very far away. You go back 3 times a year. Luckily, in England, there were long holidays. So Christmas, you know, Easter, summer were several months long, and that was good. But of course, it's difficult. Of course, it's difficult for young kids to be away from their parents. It is, but it does, you know, it does teach you a sense of independence. There's that is for sure.
You must have developed some great inner strength and independence through that.
I think that's very true. I definitely have. But it's an amalgamation of all that I've gone through. Yeah. So it's not just the boarding school. It's everything, really.
Yeah. The next point, the point three, you said, is the Iranian Revolution.
Yes.
And that becoming the start of your political awareness, as it was.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I say, you know, it wasn't until I was about 20 that my political conscience, my awareness kicked in, or consciousness kicked in. Because being raised in Iran under a monarchy, there was no political space. So there was nothing to think about except the system that existed as it did. And for us and for our socioeconomic level, it worked. So at that age, I was seeing this massive disruption in everything I believed. And so it was very, very, very educational. And as you know, the Iranian Revolution just happens to be the one that has persisted. Also, it's 40 years old. It's persisted for good and bad around the world and in that country for all these years. It has become, it wasn't just an overnight uprising and things just changed. I mean, the influence of the Iranian Revolution has never stopped being felt. And so, yeah, I mean, my life has been formed around this very seminal moment, not just in my own life and my own country, but what it's meant to the world and the effect it's had on politics and religion in the rest of the world.
And you know, in the immediate time, you were seeing family, friends who were being executed. You're seeing incredible turmoil. Do you think that contributed to your sense of wanting to see fairness and truth and justice?
Yes, I do. I actually do.
There was actually a strange sort of opportunity that arose with your journalism, with going into journalism, which was that you the idea had kind of been percolated, but you hadn't quite kind of acknowledged that this is what you wanted to do. But your sister was on a journalism course. And this is kind of the fourth point, I guess, in your story, is that you actually took her place. It was a moment of serendipity. Can you tell the story?
Yes, I can. And I think that's also, you know, these things that maybe people, serendipity is also such an important ingredient in all of this, because it's true. So in those couple of years between the revolution and me going to the United States, I didn't quite know what to do with my life. So I really was discombobulated. I couldn't be a doctor. I'd failed to get into medical school. Then I tried dental school. I failed to do that. I failed in all those areas. And I was trying to also work to support myself and my sister. Very fortunately, my English grandmother helped us a lot, and I will always be grateful to her. But because our parents were stuck in Iran, couldn't get money to us, you know, we were still students, essentially. I needed to work. So I worked in a store in Phoenix, in fact, in Bond Street, and I was a sales girl, and I also worked in a bar. I didn't want to be a bar girl because I didn't want to be poured and by you know, people having one too many drinks. So I decided to be the cleaner. Again, my boarding school expertise kicked in. So I cleaned before the bar opened up every day, and I earned money and paid the rent and, you know, was able to have the food and stuff like that. Very little for entertainment or discretionary. And at the time, my sister had decided that she wanted to be a journalist. Anyway, then she decided she didn't want to be a journalist, but we had paid the fees for the year and or for the term. And she bagged out before the term ended, and I went to try and recoup the fees because this was important. And the guy said there, no, sorry, we can't do that. So I said, okay, fine. I'm very unwasteful. I don't waste stuff. I said, okay, fine, I'm gonna do this course then. I could not bear the idea of them sitting on that money and us just you know, losing it. So I said, I'm going to come. I'll do the course. And so they said, okay. And I did. And I finished that term out. And then that's what really solidified it for me. So that from that moment, I then applied to university in the United States. And that's when I started studying journalism and really had the, not just the desire, but the focus and the plan in place.
I think it's such a great story because we kind of, you know, the story of a great woman, you know, and it's not always that you have a focus and you drive for it and you go for it and you get it. Sometimes, you know, it's a winding road and opportunities come and things like that. I just want to go back to something you were saying then, which I think is important to talk about, is that, you know, you talk about ambition and wanting to fulfill your potential and things like that, that people talk about when they talk about career journeys, but you also needed to make money. And I think that's a really important thing to say, right? You had a need too.
Yes, I did. Yes, I mean, I couldn't rely on the bank of mom and dad anymore, which many people were. And, you know, we're talking now, I mean, it's more than 40 years ago, you know, and yes. And then there was the revolution and they couldn't get money to us because they were in Iran. You know, all the banks were closed and transfers were refused, etc. So I did have to, you know, make my own way. I mean, today and even then, people just do that as a matter of course. I mean, since time immemorial, people have had to make money. It just sort of hit me at a time when I wasn't expecting it. I thought I'd go through university, study, get my credentials, get my job, etc. Then be able to, you know, sort myself out in that way. But like many, many students have to go through these things. And I'm glad I did because it not just increases experience, it builds empathy. You know, it's because of all these things that I went through that I think I'm an empathetic person. And I think that's what I bring to my job. But when I was very lucky, when I went to the US and, you know, American universities are expensive, and this wasn't Ivy League, it was a state school in Rhode Island, it was great, the University of Rhode Island. My grandmother helped me, and so did my great aunt. And, you know, two great women who had never really worked themselves, who loved their granddaughter, who wanted to pitch in, and did. And because of that help with fees, I am where I am today. And I really, really acknowledge the huge debt. I remember telling them, I will repay you, you know.
More women helping women again.
Yes.
That's what we like to see.
Yes, it's very important that. I've always believed, and these were my family, of course, but in general, women should be helping women. And there's such, I've learned this too, such a prevalence of even unconscious bias by women against women. And even, you know, sometimes, you know, jealousy and a lack of understanding and empathy. I don't think that's the majority of the case, thank God. But, and I do believe, as Madeleine Albright said famously, there is a special place in hell reserved for women who do not help other women, because we really need to. We're all in this together.
Absolutely. And there is a kind of internalized misogyny, isn't there, where we feel that there isn't enough space for all of us, you know, that we're competing. You know, if there's an Amanpour, then I can't be a journalist because she's already taken up that spot. And of course, that's not true.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories. Okay, let's go to CNN 1983.
Yes.
How did you get the job? This is your fifth point in
your journey. Yes, this is my fifth point. Basically, another sort of slightly serendipitous. I was at university and I had gone to a career talk. And I never forget the career guy talking about this new thing that was called CNN that had come onto the, you know, onto the stage, and didn't know quite whether it would work or, you know, what it really meant. Nobody had heard of cable news 24/7 before. There was this guy, Ted Turner, who was larger than life. He said, you know, it's very difficult to know, you know, how you can get into these. I always remember him saying, maybe if you, if you ride into his office on a white stallion and present your, you know, present your CV or you know, be as sort of kind of outrageous as he, maybe he'll, you know, maybe he'll, you know, take you seriously. In other words, this was such a weird thing that nobody could imagine it lasting. And if you got a job there, well, who knew where it would lead and what it was. So I, you know, that sort of went into my bank in my brain. And when I graduated from university, I tried every of the legitimate, or not legitimate, of the established networks. So I pounded the pavement for several months and didn't get anywhere because I just didn't have the credentials. Plus, I wanted to be a correspondent and I wanted to be on the, I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. I knew I wanted to be a war correspondent. And at that time, British accents were nowhere on American television. People with, women with dark hair and dark eyes were nowhere on American television. And it was a very uniform look and sound. So then I got a job at the local television station in Rhode Island where I was at university. And that was absolutely fantastic. They, first I was an intern, then they hired me, you know, entry level position. And there somebody raised the idea of CNN again and said, ooh, one of our colleagues has just moved to CNN. So they said, why don't you try it? We've heard some English accents on CNN. And I did, I called up the, human resources, and it was literally just a phone call. They asked me 10 questions, including what's the capital of Iran, since I was, you know, and I got the job. Again, entry-level job, desk assistant, got on a plane, took my bike, suitcase. I think I had about $100 saved up, and off I went. And that was the beginning for me. And it's, you know, there are lots of points and turning points, but the thing that I really want to emphasize is that it was a methodical, joyful, fun, learning, climbing of the ladder. And I climbed every single rung, and I know every single aspect of my business because I have done it all. And it gave me competence, but it also created this amazing sense of camaraderie, teamwork, and the rest is just built on that.
And so there were other journalists with you when you started. You know, you say you went up every single rung. This is maybe an embarrassing question to ask, but what made you become who you are? What did you do that other people wouldn't do or didn't do? What do you think got you to this, you know, to being Amanpour full stop with her own show?
Well, I don't know. I've never really thought about that, actually. I think there were a lot of colleagues who were ambitious and working hard, and many of them succeeded. Katie Couric was at CNN. She went on to NBC. And there are lots of names like that. For me, I would say it was an absolute willingness and desire to work over and above the call of duty, and to pitch in and to educate myself and to get experience on my off my own bat, even if it meant coming in extra hours and not being paid for what I was doing. It was really worth it for me to learn because it was fun. It was really fun as well. So it was, I think, for sure ambition, for sure goal-oriented. But I knew what I wanted to do at the end. At the end of this rainbow was my foreign correspondence job. And so I did everything I could to make sure that I got there. And I wanted to be in the field and I wanted to tell the stories that were shaking the world. And when I got out into the field, then I started to build layers on my, you know, my experience, on my level of ability. It just kept growing. And I think I was always focused on the human story. So maybe that's the distinguishing character. It's always the human story, and that's what I do.
And being wanting to be a war correspondent, wanting to be a foreign correspondent, what was it about that you so desired? Was it to be at the center of the most important things happening?
Yes.
Was it fame? Was it money? What was it?
You know, I'm sure that at the beginning I probably thought, wow, this is great. You know, I can be famous and I can get money and I can see the world and I can do it on somebody else's dime, and all these famous war correspondents, you know, from World War II to, you know, wherever till now, you know, and history. I loved history. I loved, events. I love being in the middle of events. And I also throughout, and this from my childhood, very, very curious person. I'm always asking questions. I always have my nose in places where either I shouldn't or whatever. And I'm very, very curious. And I always wanted to know what was happening and why it was happening. And I guess that's what motivated me as well.
Getting to where you were, you had to go above and beyond. You had to work really, really hard. And you had to sacrifice for a long time having relationships and a quote unquote normal life. But then you did become a mother, 0.6 in your journey. You became a mom at 42. And what change did that have? What change did that create in your life?
Well, look, I always said that when I was, and I'll say this because I can do it on Zoom, when I was balls to the wall as a foreign correspondent in danger zones where my life was at risk, where so many of my colleagues were injured and killed, where I, you know, was only interested in the job, I was married to the job, I know that I could not have maintained a marriage or motherhood if I had that responsibility at home and that desire to be at home. I know for me that I couldn't have had it all at one time, particularly at my age. And because I was a bit of a late starter, having been, you know, early on sort of swayed and moved off my trajectory. But on the road, I fell in love many times. I had phenomenal relationships. It was, you know, very, very, very special period of love and of danger and of compassion and of being in it together for the same end and you know, real soldiers.
Exciting.
Yeah, but also with a mission, you know, on the front lines of truth and eyewitness to the human condition. Anyway, later, I thought, my gosh, I do actually need to think about my life, my personal life. Everybody, I'm sure, comes to that idea at some point. And I was fortunate, you know, I fell in love, I got married, and I had my fantastic son. And my marriage didn't survive, although 20 years was a long time. But motherhood is possibly an experience, well, it is, unlike any other. And it is the kind of love and the kind of all-in involvement that I think you're never prepared for, you never imagined, and it comes with so much joy and also pain. Also, you know, it's not easy, it's phenomenal, because you also have to disassociate yourself after a while. You can't always be the helicopter mother, you can't always be the person who's trying to protect your child. Your instinct is to do that. And you know, when you hear George Floyd's last words at 46 years old, with the policeman's knee on his neck, calling for his mother who was dead, you understand the bond between mother and child, between child and mother. But you also, at least for me and for most mothers, you have to learn that you have to let them free. They have to be their own people. And that, I hope, will be eventually my son's greatest accomplishment, being his own person. And my challenge and test will be to allow him to do that.
And how, this is a question that a lot of women don't like being asked, but I think as a mum myself who works, how did you manage the balancing of work and, or not even balancing, the juggling of work and motherhood? Because it's killing most working mothers. How did you do it?
It's very, very difficult. And I will simply not deny the fact that I had help. My husband at the time was home for quite a lot of the time, but also I had an incredible, you know, support network, whether it was nanny, whether it was a housekeeper, who are still in my life. You know, these are what I call, you know, co-parents. These are deputy moms as well. And, you know, great school, nursery school, this and that, friends, play dates. It was an operation.
Not just the practicalities, but also psychologically having to make choices. Do you go to somewhere dangerous?
I did have to think very carefully, because one of the things that did change, obviously, was that before I was a mother, and when I was younger, I felt immortal, or I didn't care as much about staying alive. I did, but it wasn't forefront of my mind. And I did actually care. And I'm proud to say that I have never been injured, but more importantly, that nobody in my teams, in the most dangerous of situations, not one person in my team with me on the ground has been injured and, God forbid, killed. So I'm very aware of the parameters. And I'm not cavalier, but the level of fear was less when I was not a mother. And the level of fear was high when I did become a mother. So I still did stuff, but I was more careful.
What is your advice to women who are trying to make it work in the family and work balance?
My advice is to don't torture yourself. It's very difficult. And give yourself a break. And try your best to juggle the best way you can. And don't imagine that life is perfect and there's such a thing as a perfect work-life balance. It doesn't exist. And it's something that only happens, you know, the older you get, because then your child grows up and things sort of fall into place in different ways. So I think I would say be kind to yourself, be kind to your family, do the very best you can, and know that certain things will fall through the cracks. And don't beat yourself up and don't feel guilty. Go for it.
Yeah. And you have a son. How much do you try to give him feminist education?
Well, this is something very, very important. Obviously, as a woman, you can't literally force it down. But hopefully, I have been an example for hopefully many of the women he knows through me, through his, you know, his experience in life are examples as well. He's obviously a very well-educated boy. He's lived a life with his eyes open. He's traveled a lot. He knows. In his room, I ripped out of a magazine, a fashion magazine, a picture of Jennifer Lawrence, who was the fashion brand for Dior. And the t-shirt she's wearing is, "We should all be feminists." And it's what Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie says as well. We should all be feminists, men and women alike. And I think my son knows that unless there's equality between men and women, between his mother and all the other men in the world, there will never be a healthy world. It won't be healthy for men and boys. It won't be healthy for girls and women. And it's not a either or. It's not male, you know, patriarchy and dominance to be replaced by female matriarchy. And it's not that at all. It has to be an equal endeavor.
And that it's better for them as well, ultimately.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, I'm aware that I have to let you go. I don't want to hold you up too much. I'm going to ask you two quick questions, very quick ones at the end, about moments. One good one, one bad one. When you look back, is there a moment that just makes you cringe with how embarrassingly awful it was? I know that Yasser Arafat put the phone down on you. Is that
the moment.
Is it?
That and when President Clinton said, "There have been no flip-flops, madam," when I challenged him on a live link about his administration's flip-flops on Bosnia and the continuing, you know, slaughter of civilians there. And he came right back at me. I said, "Why have there been so many flip-flops?" And he said that, and then every world leader anywhere I went after that, people called me madam. So that was interesting. And the president was very gracious to me afterwards. So that it all was fine, but it was a very difficult moment on global live television. And Yasser Arafat, which was several years later, as the Israeli military was coming with tanks into his headquarters in the West Bank. And, you know, walls were being shattered and he was kind of being imprisoned. And I asked him, I can't even remember what I asked him. And he says, "Don't you know you are talking to General Arafat?" Boom, he put the phone down, because at that time it was a live phone interview. My face was on camera, his voice was on the phone. So everybody could see me blushing around the world and like, I'm just being hung up on. So those were the bad ones.
I mean, just about the Clinton one, how do you build up the courage to ask that question that you know is going to really, you know, it's going to be a punch in the guts for him? How do you do that?
Well, I didn't intend it to be a punch in the gut, but I was listening to everything he was saying, and I'm a reporter, and I was in the field witnessing what I was witnessing, and I could not ask the question that I asked. And that's what it is, you know, you just have to, if you're going to have this platform, you're going to have to be able to use it. And I am always... mindful of the fact that many of my viewers, let's say people recognize me in the street. And one thing they always say to me is, why didn't you ask that question? Or thank you for asking that question. I'm mindful that I am, in a way, sometimes also asking questions that people want answered. And I think that I also don't go out wanting to be liked. I don't. I wanted to get the job done.
Okay, my final question is, this is the nice one. If you look back and think of a memory of happiness that you go to when you need to, you know, find your happy place, what would that be?
It has to be my son. It has to be, you know, of course, when he was born and, you know, in many of the most fantastic moments, childhood discoveries, you know, just empathy and love and joy and just innocence. That's my happy place.
Christian Amanpour, thank you so much for sharing your moments.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. This podcast was edited by Lauren Lind, and it was all brought to you by The Female Lead. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com, or our Instagram, or our Twitter, or Facebook, or TikTok, or LinkedIn, you name it, we're there for you. See you next time.